Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative, and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the executive editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with the lead author of an original article that appears in the June 2020 issue. With us today is Dr. John Greenland. Dr. Greenland is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a staff physician at the San Francisco VA Medical Center. He has an interesting track to where he is today. He received his undergraduate degree from Stanford and completed his PhD through the Harvard Graduate Program in Virology. He received an MD from the Harvard MIT Division of Health Science and Technology, the HST program. Dr. Greenland is the first author of a special article that appears in the June 2020 issue of the journal, and it is titled COVID-19 Infection, Implications for Perioperative and Critical Care Physicians. Dr. Greenland, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Dr. Rathmel, and thanks for having me. I have to credit Drs. Michael O. Wang in London, who did an enormous amount of research for this.
Yeah, a team effort, and it was a tremendous team effort. I think a little bit of background there. Obviously, this coronavirus infection pandemic has hit a certain point here. We're recording at the end of the second week of March, and things are really heating up here in Boston. They've heated up in California, and we're all preparing for what is to come. So we don't know what's to come, but this is a really nice sprint to get us some information that may be extremely helpful for protecting anesthesiologists and critical care doctors. So nice work on assembling a really timely review in this rapidly evolving epidemic and synthesizing really concrete recommendations for anesthesiologists and intensivists to use as a guide. I want you to start by telling us a little bit about COVID-19 virus. And I know you have expertise in virology, and I'm glad you brought that to help us here. We've all been following the story as it emerged in Wuhan, China, but maybe you can share some of the details about how the epidemic emerged, what a coronavirus actually is, and how this particular coronavirus got its name, and then the pathogenesis of the virus.
The coronavirus story starts with bats. Bats are unique mammals. They live in caves that are as crowded as 300 bats per square foot, and they can fly up to 800 miles for their winter migrations. So maybe because of all this contact, they coexist with a large number of endemic viruses. Some familiar names would be Ebola, Nipah, Marburg, rabies, Rift Valley fever, chikungunya, as well as the coronaviruses. Bats have evolved potent antiviral interferon responses that would put primate cells to shame. So when these viruses go from bats into humans, they're highly lethal. COVID-19 is short for Coronavirus Disease 2019. And that term refers to the syndrome rather than the virus itself. The virus is called Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2, or SARS-CoV-2, because of its similarity to the SARS virus from 2002. SARS coronavirus 2 infects cells with the ACE2 receptor, and it takes over the cell's protein and RNA synthesis machinery to copy itself. Despite SARS coronavirus 2 strategies to hide from the immune system, there's a powerful immune response, and that may be part of the reason why patients progress to acute respiratory distress syndrome and shock.
So what's the typical presentation of a patient with COVID-19, and how do you make the diagnosis?
Per the CDC guidelines, the typical presentation is fever, cough, and shortness of breath, which appear 2 to 14 days after exposure. Myalgias and fatigue are also common flu-like symptoms that likely reflect the body's interferon responses. Interestingly, cardiac and renal injury have also been reported, which could be directly related to the virus infection of cardiac myocytes and renal tubular epithelial cells through the ACE2 receptor. or might reflect indirect effects of shock. Honestly, we don't necessarily know all of the possible presentations, since people are generally only tested who meet certain case definitions. The diagnosis is made using PCR methods based on upper and lower airway samples in patients who have concerning symptoms.
So I want to emphasize the long and variable incubation period and the fact that many individuals have little or no symptoms even when they can transmit the disease to others. How does the diagnostic test for COVID-19 work? How accurate is the test, and how long does it typically take to get results?
The COVID-19 test works by converting viral RNA to DNA and then amplifying viral sequences in a PCR machine. The more cycles it takes to amplify out this portion of the virus, the less virus is in the sample. When validated, these PCR-based tests are very specific. However, you can get a false negative if there isn't much virus around when the test is done, which can occur either early or late in the disease course. This is particularly a problem since the virus is most active in the lower respiratory tract, which is a region that's not usually sampled. There are also antibody serology tests that are coming, but they are not widely available yet.
Yeah, that's a little bit about what goes into getting a nasal swab. It can't be the anterior nares. It has to go back a little bit closer to the very posterior pharynx, so pretty uncomfortable to have done. You know, the availability of testing for COVID-19 has come under great scrutiny this last week or so in the United States because it's lagged so far behind other nations. Can you tell us why that is? Do you have any understanding of that lag?
Well, making a reliable test in large quantities over a short time span is easier said than done. So each lab needs to have the appropriate reagents and validate that their method works. Also, the initial CDC design test had a faulty reagent, and that was one cause of delay. In some cases, it may be difficult for labs to obtain the appropriate reagents because of global shortages. And that can be particularly true if the lab wants to design a custom test. Despite this regrettably slow start, testing capabilities are ramping up quickly now, and we are expecting to see sharp increases in the number of identified cases resulting from increased testing.
So there is great variability in the presentation in the clinical course of COVID-19 cases. What are some of the determinants of the severity of illness associated with the infection?
There's a lot we don't know about why some people get sicker than others. Older people certainly seem more affected than younger people. This likely reflects age-related changes in the immune system. Children can definitely contract SARS coronavirus 2, but the presentation appears milder, and so probably many are not being tested. Like we said, the virus uses the receptor ACE2. ACE2 is expressed in the lower airways, but interestingly, ACE2 is also expressed in the small intestine, and that might explain a GI presentation of abdominal pain and diarrhea. In fact, in the JAMA case series, one patient who was admitted to the surgical service with abdominal complaints infected 10 providers before appropriate isolation could be implemented. ACE2 is increased by ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers that are used to treat hypertension. Some people think that this might explain why hypertension is a risk factor for worse outcomes.
So there's a small subset of patients, likely 5% or less, that will develop respiratory failure. What do we know about how best to manage this subgroup? And specifically, what's the role for and the risks of using high-flow oxygen via nasal cannula and non-invasive positive pressure ventilation?
Management guidelines for hypoxemic respiratory failure in COVID-19 are primarily drawn from ARDS, with the addition of airborne isolation to prevent transmission. In patients with worsening hypoxemia, transitioning from low-flow nasal cannula to heated, humidified, high-flow nasal cannula seems reasonable. There's really no clear evidence that this would increase the amount of virus in the air. It's not that high flow is particularly safe. It's just that low flow nasal cannula also can cause aerosolized droplets. Also, the humidification may decrease the range of droplet spread. Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation is okay as well, especially for someone with coexisting COPD or heart failure. In both cases, the guidelines appropriately caution against waiting too long to intubate.
So one of the most helpful aspects of your article is a table where you list the practical recommendations to guide anesthetic and critical care management of patients who have COVID-19. Can you summarize those practical recommendations for listeners?
I have to thank Marilyn Michelow for putting that table together. In short, providers need to be prepared to intubate an unstable patient under airborne precautions. That means labeling the patient rooms so that COVID-19 cases are clear, having kits available for intubation and cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and practicing the use of personal protective equipment, which is at least a gown, an N95 mask, cap, face shields, and gloves. A PPE champion can be helpful to watch and ensure that donning and doffing are correctly performed. And this is especially useful for the powered air purifying respirators or PAPRs, which are somewhat more complicated. We'd suggest allowing time to prepare and intubating early to avoid emergency intubations. When doing the intubation, we recommend pre-oxygenation and doing rapid sequence induction with rocuronium if possible. Providers should avoid masking, but if you have to, put a filter between the bag and the mask. Video laryngoscopy can be helpful to maximize the distance between the provider and aerosolized droplet. Once the endotracheal tube is in place, inflate the cuff immediately. Hospitals will also need to consider how to perform transport and keep critical care beds available.
I want to elaborate on one of the pieces you just spoke about, and that's the differentiation between droplet precautions and airborne precautions, because it's important. Both CMS and the CDC in this last 24 or 48 hours have come out with recommendations that have kind of downgraded a bit from airborne precautions because there's evidence that COVID-19 is spread by droplets rather than by airborne precautions. Can you tell us about that differentiation and what it means for the N95 versus plain old surgical masks?
The N95 mask is important for airborne precautions. The difference between droplet and airborne precautions is the idea that small particles containing viruses could travel far in cases where there were high viral loads in patients. And in that case, airborne isolation is necessary. We think that patients who are critically ill, such as would need intubation and high flow nasal cannula or mechanical ventilation, are probably at high risk. And we would continue to recommend the use of airborne isolation precautions, including an N95 mask when doing intubation for those patients.
Perfect. But perhaps in those with very low viral loads, the plain surgical mask may suffice, or those who are asymptomatic, because plain old surgical masks do suffice for droplet precautions alone. Is that correct?
Right. I think that the data is incomplete to guide clinicians as to exactly which precautions are necessary. But the CDC guidelines are reasonable that in patients who are relatively healthy, who would have fairly low viral loads, probably droplet precautions are sufficient.
He says, as a virologist, very cautiously. Very well. So you discuss several potential therapeutic antiviral therapies in your paper. Tell us more about the likelihood that an effective treatment might emerge for this COVID-19.
There's a lot of enthusiasm for remdesivir. That's a nucleotide analog that inhibits the COVID-19 virus RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. This drug was actually developed for Ebola, but it proved less effective than monoclonal antibodies. Unfortunately, we don't have monoclonal antibodies for SARS coronavirus 2 yet. Remdesivir and chloroquine were shown to block SARS-CoV-2 in cell culture, and remdesivir is currently being studied in 5 clinical trials. Lopinavir, ritonavir, otherwise known as Keytruda, is a protease inhibitor combination that's used for HIV, and it's been used for COVID-19 based on limited data from the first SARS epidemic. Keytruda has known side effects, and some people are doubting its efficacy. While this might not be the right agent, coronaviruses are definitely dependent on proteases, and so some protease inhibitor down the line may prove to be effective. Steroids are not recommended based on WHO and CDC guidelines currently. However, based on the prominent features of hyperactive immune responses and organizing pneumonia, steroid therapy is being addressed in some randomized clinical trials. At the moment, the best treatment option probably involves being enrolled in a clinical trial where available. There are currently 30 interventional COVID-19 clinical trials that are recruiting patients.
Well, any final words of advice for anesthesiologists and intensivists who want to minimize the risk of transmitting this virus and are in the trenches? We're right here poised at what might be the start of the very rapid doubling of cases in the next few weeks.
Well, like airborne precautions, much of the advice is common sense. Screening patients for fever, cough, dyspnea, and flu-like symptoms before entering the hospital can help identify patients at risk and protect providers from inadvertent transmission. Providers should definitely wash their hands and stay home if they're sick. We'd also recommend avoiding unnecessary gatherings and practicing social distancing when possible. And last, I would say to be sure to get enough sleep.
Well, we're here on Friday the 13th, poised. The things that are going on today in the evolution of this epidemic in both San Francisco and in Boston are cancellation of elective surgeries and procedures and closing of outpatient clinics to reduce the community-acquired transmission of the disease. So we will see where things go. I want to thank you, John, very much for joining me today, and I hope the discussion is going to lead many of those that are listening to read the new article. It'll appear in the June 2020 issue, and you can learn much more about COVID-19 and the practical recommendations for anesthesiologists and intensivists. Dr. John Wanderer from Vanderbilt and I also created an infographic that appears in the same issue, and it highlights the current recommendations put forward in Dr. Greenland's article. Dr. Greenland, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.